Thank you, Tombert. Tombert, did I tell you that I love you? Did I tell you that I love you? You're a great brother in Christ, a real great brother in Christ. Can I come over for lunch one day? Okay, I have all these witnesses in front of me. As we looked at briefly last week, Joshua chapters 13 to 19, these seven chapters, it's basically about the division of the land of Canaan to the 12 tribes of Israel and their inheritance of it. Now chapters 20 and 21 follow these land allotment chapters as they represent another phase, a second phase in the dividing up of these lands. You see, first, God gave the promised land to Israel in chapters 13 to 19. And then Israel gave back some of this land to God in chapters 20 and 21 in the form of cities and towns, cities of refuge and towns for the Levites in order to set them apart, in order for it set aside for God's specific purposes. Now today, we'll look closer at chapter 20, at these towns of refuge, these cities of refuge represented by these red squares on the map. And we'll try to gain a better understanding of their significance. Why were they important? What was their purpose? Better yet, what was God's purpose for these cities? Being cities of refuge. In Exodus chapter 21, verse 12, in that time, we see that capital offenses such as premeditated murder was to be punished by death. Verse 12 says, anyone who strikes a person with a fatal blow is to be put to death. But accidental killing was not. Verse 13, however, if it is not done intentionally, but God lets it happen, they are to flee to a place I will designate, says the Lord. You see, there were to be six cities of refuge within this land, three on each side of the Jordan River. And they were to be set aside as places of refuge to those who had accidentally killed another person. And they needed to find safety from those wanting to avenge the death of a family member. These cities were positioned such that they're no more than a day's journey away, no matter where you were in the land. Now, a city of refuge applies only to accidental, unintentional killings, ones that were done by mistake or inadvertently and without prior planning. Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 5 to 6, gives us an example of what is considered accidental. For instance, a man may go into the forest with his neighbor to cut wood, and as he swings his axe to fell a tree, the head may fly off and hit his neighbor and kill him. That man may flee to one of these cities and save his life. Otherwise, the avenger of blood might pursue him in a rage, overtake him if the distance is too great, and kill him even though he's not deserving of death, since he did it to his neighbor without malice aforethought. But nonetheless, you know, in today's terminology, this is considered negligent homicide or manslaughter. The act of killing someone still constitutes a blood guilt, that is, guilty of shedding blood. And future retaliation by family members is very real. So if the offender, that is, if the person who killed desires refuge, he is to go to the closest city of refuge, and he must present his case to the elders at the city gate. This is equivalent to a preliminary hearing, so to speak, to determine if the case qualifies. If it does, he receives the protection of the city, and the officials cannot hand him over to the avenger of blood, who is usually a male relative of the deceased. Since the killer's actions were seen as unintentional, it wasn't his fault, the city becomes his refuge against revenge, and the offender may stay. He may stay there as the trial verifies his claim. An unverified claim, however, means that he'll be expelled, and therefore he'll be susceptible to retribution by the dead person's family. While a verified claim means that he can stay, he can remain in the city, but he's not to be set free. That is, not until the presiding high priest, after his death, then he can go free. Because this death of the high priest somehow is seen as an atoning for people's sins. And it marks the appropriate time frame in which to free those who are living in asylum. Now, only the high priest's death can release the offender from his exile and bring him home once again. This was a foreshadowing. This was a wonderful picture for us of what our merciful great high priest, the Lord Jesus Christ himself, has done for us on the cross. In Hebrews chapter 2, verse 17, it says, "For this reason, he," that is Jesus, "had to be made like them, fully human in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people." So in essence, these cities of refuge are then places where the Lord's mercy, where the Lord's grace, his compassion can be found. And the sheer number of them, having six of them in such a small area, show how available God's justice really is. Our God is a merciful judge. Now, in today's world, it seems like we're so far removed. We're so far removed from this system, from this Israelite institution, from this concept of cities of refuge. You see, today we have various laws. We have structures in place in our societies, such as protective police custody or court-issued restraining orders that protect us from needing to flee to another city for safety. So how can we bring this biblical concept of a city of refuge into our culture in which we live? What are some transferable principles that we can take from this passage and apply it to our world today? Well, one thing that we can think about is, instead of having cities of refuge, do our churches function as places of refuge for those who are in need of God's mercy, for those who are in need of God's grace, God's compassion, his protection, and his justice? Being cities, being churches of refuge, being churches of refuge. What does it mean to be churches of refuge? How do they look like? Well, they're merciful and they're safe places. They're merciful and safe places. You know, every now and then, we screw up in life, don't we? We make mistakes. We make bad decisions. We succumb to pressure and temptation. And we are in need of mercy and compassion in our lives. You know, as a teen growing up, I specifically remember two instances in my life when I did things that I shouldn't have done. Well, probably more than two, but at least two that stands out in my mind anyways. One was when I was 13 years old, and I was playing around with my younger brothers, both of them of which are in this room today. And my parents had just gone out. They went out for the night, and we're playing around, and we just had moved into this house. This is a brand new house we just moved into. And we're goofing around upstairs in the bedroom floor, and we're running around the hallways, and as I was making this turn, I was wearing socks, and I slipped on the carpet, and I just went bang right into the wall. And not only did I go into the wall, my knee went into the wall, and it created literally a hole this big, and my mouth just dropped. My brother's mouth dropped. We looked at each other. We did not know what to do. And I thought to myself, well, let's cover it up. So I got a sheet of paper, white paper, and just tried taping around it. You know, I can still see right through the paper. The hole was like was quite big, and you can see the hole right through it. And so I said, I looked around for a piece of white cardboard, you know, a thicker piece of cardboard, and I cut it to size, and I fit it into the hole, and I taped around it. Because the thickness was so big, you can see shadow lines around the edge. And so that didn't work. But nonetheless, I just went to bed. But as I went to bed, I just kind of thought to myself, you know what? I'm going to get in trouble. That's it. My dad's going to get upset and totally angry with me. So I woke up even a couple hours afterwards before my dad came home, and I wrote a note. I kind of confessed what I did. And I was tempted to write down my brother's name as the person who did it. But I'm not that cowardly. I went to bed. I woke up the next morning. That's one instance in which I felt I did something I shouldn't have done. The second time, I was a little bit older, about 17, 18 years old. I went to a bachelor party, and I was not a Christian at this time. I did not have any I did not have any Christian friends. I did not go to church. And during this bachelor party, people were doing things and drinking and everything. And the next thing I know, I was just hanging all over the toilet. I just could not even stand up straight. I could not even sit straight. I was gone for the rest of the night. I was brought home, and I woke up in the middle of the night. I said, my dad's going to kill me for this. In both these instances, I didn't know what to tell my dad. I dreaded having to tell my dad what happened. I even thought of ways to get around it by hiding it. To my great surprise, he showed me mercy and compassion. If you know my dad, he's not that type of guy. He's very strict, at least back then he was. And he would let us know when we did something wrong. But for whatever reason, in these two instances, in both cases, he came into my room, he asked me how I was doing, and he just said to me, don't do it again. And that was it. Sometimes we screw up in life, but we need to receive mercy. In the Old Testament, these cities of refuge were places where mercy was extended to those who had suffered an unfortunate incident in their lives. Our churches should be places where people can flee from their screw-ups, from the misfortunes in life, in order to find mercy. This describes both what we do and do not do. We show an unexpected amount of kindness by refraining from judging or punishing those who've done wrong in life. Unfortunately, we're not very good at this. We're quick to pass judgment, quick to seek revenge, quick to take action prematurely. Are we a place of refuge? Are we a church of refuge? What are some signs that indicate that a church is a place of refuge? In answering this question, Robert Hubbard describes it this way. What traits typify a church of refuge? He says this, its primary concern is with today and tomorrow, not yesterday. When people approach its front door, they sense they're entering a non-threatening, safe place. They sense a place where their past will never get in the way of relationships or come back to haunt them. It is as if there's a sign posted outside saying, your past, good or bad, doesn't matter here. Welcome. Once inside, the prime concern is, how are you, the real you, doing today? What are your hopes and dreams, and how can we help? Where the talk of the past is important is left up to the individual. He or she is free to bring it up if doing so meets a need. A safe church keeps its rules on file for emergencies rather than impose them every time they apply. It's a place where, in the words of James 2:13, mercy triumphs over judgment. Yes, churches have rules, biblical standards of conduct and expectations, but refuge churches apply them only when necessary, and then gently and sorrowfully to let people be who they are, warts and all, and leave the transformation business to God. He's a lot better at it than they are anyway. Thirdly, a safe church grows members well aware of their own warts. Its rank structure is while it has none. People may serve different organizational functions within it, but they enjoy the same status. They're all forgiven sinners, nothing more, nothing less. Finally, a safe church gives people the God treatment. It treats people the same way God has treated them, with mercy and compassion. It works hard to live out Jesus' teaching that among his people, the greatest is the slave who serves everyone else first. Being churches of refuge, they're merciful and safe places. They're also generous and hospitable places. Not only are churches of refuge those who are known for giving grace to people in life, but they're also known as churches who provide for tangible help. That is, they're generous, they're hospitable as well. In Joshua chapter 20, verses 1 and 2, the Lord commanded Joshua to give of these cities of refuge from their own inheritance, to give it back, to give it some of this land back to God for his purposes. One commentator said this: to serve as a city of refuge commits a city to certain responsibilities. It has to maintain its outer walls and gates in secure condition. Its leaders must be ready to hold trials on short notice and must make sure they know what they're doing. Its citizens have to set aside lodging for asylum seekers to integrate them into town life and not treat them as intruders or suspects. It commits a town to sacrifice its own wishes in order to serve the common good. All that to say, it understands and it takes the heart of what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 10, verse 8. Freely you have received, freely give. You know, none of this, the building, the lights, the AV equipment, the piano, the carpet, the chairs, the land, even phase 3, should I dare to speak, none of this belongs to us. It's been given to us by God. Will we give up our desire of what our church could be, whatever that may look like in your minds or in your perception? Now, I don't know what comes to mind when you think of and you envision Fraserlands Church, but whatever that is, would you give it up to be a church, to be a place of refuge for others in need of God's mercy, compassion, and grace? Whenever Deb and I travel to other cities during our vacation, we try to make it a point to visit other churches. And in our limited travel, we've been to a few churches and experienced churches of all sorts. First, I'd like to call the first church a no-hands church. They don't do anything with their hands. They don't shake people with their hands. They don't clap their hands. They don't raise their hand in worship. This is a no-hands church. And then we've been to those all-hands church. You know, you come in, they greet you right away. They not only greet you, they hug you, they embrace you. You know, they clap when they sing. They raise their hand in worship. They raise their hand in prayer. They raise their hand as they try to pray for people to be healed at the all-hands church. I think we're somewhere in between. And then there's the shopping mall church. You've maybe been to those. It's a humongous church. You walk in and the foyer is bigger than the sanctuary. It's twice, three times, four times the size of the sanctuary. And there's a large cafeteria in there, humongous cafeteria. And not only that, in the foyer area, There are corners for everyone. There's a children's corner, there's a teens corner, there's an adults corner, there's a seniors corner, there's a women's corner, there's a corner for everything. There's a counseling center upstairs. And just before you get into the two doors of the sanctuary, there's two doors leading in the middle of that is a 40-foot waterfall. It's a shopping mall church. Again, nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying that's what churches have been to. And then there's the anti-shopping mall church, a very intimate place. It feels as if it's someone's home. You feel like you're part of the family. And one other type of church we've been to was a very territorial, possessive type of church. And you know what? So you know, I don't know why it's the case. Why is it that when you are new to a church, you come early? You notice that? Do you guys do that? When you go to church, you're new, you actually get there early? Well, we were there about half an hour earlier than normal. And we sat down, probably somewhere where Paul and Anita are. And so we sat there. About half an hour earlier, people came in, and as they came in, they did things like this. And then they sat down. And then this, and it happened like a few times. And then this one last couple came in. Literally, I'm not joking when I said that. They came in, they came like this. And they kind of almost counted the seats. And they knew that Deb and I were sitting in their seats. They totally knew we were sitting there. And they gave us the stare, that eye treatment for the longest of time. And they refused to leave. They were just standing here. And then after a while, the wife just nudged the husband, and they finally took a seat somewhere in this area. Deb and I felt so uncomfortable. We felt so uncomfortable. We actually didn't stay in the service. We went out of the sanctuary, went to the teen service where Chris was at the time. We worshiped there. We had a great time of worship. Phraselands Church, please don't be that type of church. If someone else is sitting in your seat, graciously take another seat. And then there's a church in Erbil, Iraq. We haven't been there before. But there's a church in Erbil, Iraq, where many people have come to find refuge. Where many people have come to find refuge and safety and protection and mercy. I want to show you this video of this church of refuge, I call it. It was just aired on ABC 2020 over this past Christmas, just about maybe, I don't know, 2 weeks ago. It was aired on ABC 2020. I was greatly encouraged by this church. I was greatly encouraged by this pastor, this shepherd. His name is Father Douglas Bazzi. I just want to show you this video.
This is where we need to go, I think.
As Joseph and Michelle Assad work their way across the globe, their minds are focused on their destination.
All right, we gotta catch our flight.
The northern Iraqi city of Erbil, where the ancient citadel and bustling central market sit amid a forest of half-built high-rises. The streets, for the most part, are peaceful. But a savage war is just on the horizon. The city is unmistakably Muslim. But drive into the district of Ankawa and you pass a statue of the Virgin Mary. You enter an area Christians have been calling home for 1,000 years. We enter the grounds of a modest church called Mar Aliyah to meet Father Douglas Bazzi.
Hello, Father Douglas.
Hello. Hi.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth.
For years, he has been here reading the gospel written in Aramaic, the language of Iraqi Christians, and the original language of Jesus. But Mar Aliyah is more than a house of worship. Today, it is a haven for 560 Christian refugees who have fled the horrors of ISIS, living here in the courtyard for the past 15 months, less than an hour's drive from the fighting.
How concerned are you about the security situation? How concerned are the people who live here?
Do you think we have choices? We don't have choices here. I'm surprised how my people still exist here. By the way, I never call it camp.
You don't call it a camp?
No, I call it center.
Uh-huh. Under an asphalt sky, Father Douglas leads us into the warren of metal containers called caravans.
So obviously this is the wash, and this is where they cook.
Yeah.
Each one housing an entire family.
How many people live here?
Six.
Six people in this?
In this caravan.
And as we spoke to the people surviving here, we pieced together the story of how this all came to be.
Actually, it was terrible. I don't want to remember that.
The refugees come from a town called Karakosh, once a town of 50,000, the largest Christian-majority city in Iraq.
We thought like Karakosh is a peaceful place.
On August 6th, 2014, that all ended when ISIS mortars began raining down from the sky. Lillian Sakat is a 24-year-old kindergarten teacher.
When they began bombing, two children and a woman died.
Allahu Akbar!
Just days before, in a nearby town, ISIS took women and young girls as sex slaves. So for Rita Khalil and her older sister Rania, the choice was simple.
Was that part of why you knew you had to run?
Of course, we are so scared to do the same thing with us.
Within hours, tens of thousands of people fled the town in chaos and headed for the safety of Erbil. The roads were choked with people and dust. Nissan Buttress, a retired pharmacist, captured the terror of that night on videotape. His family of 10 packed into the back of his truck.
What was that like? It must have been chaos.
It is a difficult night. Dust and child cannot able to breathe oxygen.
Others fled with little more than their most precious possessions. A Bible, a flute, a rosary, identification papers. That night, with traffic helplessly snarled, many of the refugees abandoned their vehicles and set off on foot and literally walked through the valley of the shadow of death.
They began walking?
Yeah, they began walking. And there was a lot of dust, and they were just shooting in the air. Everyone was afraid.
Father Douglas has firsthand experience of religious persecution. In 2006, he was kidnapped by Islamic extremists and tortured for 9 days. They broke his teeth, his nose, and his back.
I got shot in my leg. Still the bullet.
Where?
Still here.
The bullet is still in your leg?
Yeah.
So as the Karakosh refugees began streaming into his church, he was happy to offer them a safe haven from the horror.
When people arrive, they were completely lost and confused. They were refusing even to eat because they say, I lost everything. Why should I live?
ISIS soldiers soon invaded the town. Their demands were simple and harsh.
They were given an ultimatum, 24 hours, convert or leave.
Or be killed or to be converted.
ISIS went about its usual business, terrorizing residents who stayed. Seizing Christian homes, marking each one with the Arabic letter Noon for Nazarene. Just as they did in these nearby towns, desecrating churches.
They pulled down the cross on the church and put the flag of ISIS over all church in Karakosh.
So instead of the cross on top, there's the flag of ISIS?
Some language.
Meanwhile, Father Douglas prepared to host his new guests for an extended stay. As the days became weeks and then months, the refugees went from sleeping on the ground to sleeping in tents, and finally to the caravans we saw today. It is not the world's grittiest refugee camp, but conditions here are bleak. Children sleep like sardines. Space heaters are the only way to keep warm, as long as the electricity is running. And hundreds of people share a handful of communal bathrooms.
The same toilet, the same showers. Mm-hmm. So we have this facility here is for men and for women.
Still, everywhere we are met with friendly smiles. We notice that nearly half the camp is under the age of 18.
Hello, hello. Oh, is she blowing you kisses? That's so sweet.
Come in. Marhaba.
During the last year, 8 babies were born. This little girl, named Flower of the Spring, is just 12 days old.
Oh, she's so beautiful.
All of life happening in your courtyard?
I cannot tell my people to slow down. In our culture, at least to have occasion for happiness, it's better to not be sadness.
There are even weddings like this one, the people preserving their endangered culture. And with this nativity scene at the courtyard, preserving their religion. Home is where Jesus is.
They took our houses and we became one family. They took our churches and now we became one church. Look to our faces. Actually, we took from them everything.
The refugees know they can't stay here forever, but where do they go? The answer, when it comes, is surprising. It comes from that unlikely American couple, Joseph and Michelle Assad, now making their way here with an audacious and risky plan.
I'm worried because I have a lot of people, man, on the line.
And a magic suitcase to make it all happen.
This is incredible. It is, it's becoming a reality.
It's only part one of a 5-part series that they aired. If you want to see, I'll post it into the Fraserlands Church Facebook site later on today. There are people throughout the world who are in need of a place of refuge, whether it be in Iraq or in Syria. What can we do as a church? As you know, our church is partnering with Westwood Alliance Church and also with the district in order to support refugee families from Syria through sponsorship. If you're interested, please prayerfully consider how you may be able to maybe give financially towards this or even assisting refugee families in order to settle in the Vancouver area, as these are people who will be coming as a part of this sponsorship through the Westward Alliance Church. And to be hands-on involved, maybe through a small group you want to take on this project, or through your family, a fellowship group. If you're interested, information is all in the bulletin, and please contact Pastor Paul as a result of that. The Lord has called His church to be churches of refuge in this broken and sinful world, to provide merciful and safe places, to provide generous and hospitable places for the weary and the worn, for the broken and the bruised, for the unlovely and the unloved, so that they can find refuge. These are locations of churches within our immediate vicinity. And you probably know where our church is. Churches of all sorts, churches of all sizes, and churches of all color and language. Are we able to be churches of refuge for our neighborhood, for our surrounding community here? Are we at Fraserlands a place of refuge, a church of refuge, so that the Lord can use for His glory, for His purposes, to show love, compassion, mercy, justice to those who are in need? I'd like to ask the worship team to come up at this time. And as they do so, I want to read to you Psalm 62. Psalm 62, it says, "Yes, my soul, find rest in God. My hope comes from him. Truly, he is my rock and my salvation. He is my fortress. I will not be shaken. My salvation and my honor depend on God. He is my mighty rock, my refuge. Trust in him at all times, you people. Pour out your hearts to him, for God is our refuge. Let's stand and let's worship together, shall we?